This is a legal podcast about anything and everything to do with being an NCAer, law student, lawyer, and everything in between.
I'm Sam, and I practice family law in Calgary.
I'm Kim, and I practice estate litigation in Toronto.
This is Legally Abroad.
Hi, everybody. We're super excited to have some representatives from the Law Society of Ontario here joining us today. We have Gina Harris and Penina Brickman. And actually, what we'll do is we'll allow our guests to actually introduce themselves and tell us in their own words what the Law Society is, and especially would assist us to understand the differences between the LSO, which is the Law Society of Ontario, and the NCA, which is the National Accreditation. So without further ado, welcome Gina and Penina. Yay.
Thanks, everyone. My name is Gina Harris. I'm the manager of the licensing process and experiential training programs here at the Law Society of Ontario. I've been with the organization for over 20 years and have had the pleasure of seeing many candidates walk across the stage and become licensed. And it has been fantastic. We've evolved so much over the last 20 years, and I'm excited to share the information about the process with you today. In the meantime, I'll hand it over to Penina, who'll tell you a little bit more about us and herself.
Hi, everyone. Lovely to be chatting with you today. My name is Penina Brickman. I am the Senior Counsel and Manager of Entry Level Competence at the Law Society. What that means is that I work on a whole lot of things that span across the types of ways that you may interact with the Law Society in the coming days, weeks, months, or years. For example, I work with the team that prepares the licensing examination study materials. I work with the team that works on some of the examination questions. We work on accommodations, and we also support the licensing process area. So you may come into contact with me in the coming days. Very nice to chat with all of you. I wanted to tell you a little bit about the Law Society, if I may. The Law Society regulates licenses and disciplines. More than 57,000 Ontario lawyers and more than 10,000 paralegals in Ontario. Like many professionals in Ontario, lawyers and paralegals are self-governing. And what that means is that lawyers and paralegals oversee their own regulation through the Law Society in accordance with the Law Society Act and the regulations. When you become lawyers or paralegals at the Law Society of Ontario, you will be receiving that privilege of self-governance. So it's very important that when you have that privilege of self-governance, you act in accordance with the public interest. And that's what the Law Society is there to help all of us do.
Awesome. Thank you. And in terms of the, I guess it's important for if you're coming from law school outside of Canada, at what stage would a student or somebody who, you know, has a degree from law school would contact the Law Society and start getting involved in the licensing process?
Specifically, if they want to go back to Ontario.
Right. Thank you, Sam. It's important to mention that each province
from the Albertan over here.
Yeah. Each province has their own governing body, Law Society. And we have the privilege of speaking to Law Society of Ontario today. So it's important that you, if you want to qualify in a certain province, that you speak to your, I guess, specific Law Society. Sam, I guess your Law Society of Alberta.
Yes, exactly.
And while we could probably do 10 podcasts and speak to each Law Society, we're going to focus on Ontario, and we're very excited to speak to Law Society of Ontario. So thank you, Sam, for bringing that up.
Yes, thanks, Sam, for clarifying. So typically candidates that want to enter the process and become licensed in Ontario normally should reach out to us about 3 or 4 months before the examination that they would like to first sit. So that's typically a good timeline. It also likely coincides with when they're writing their final NCA examinations. And so that will give the applicant enough time to complete all of the, you know, application requirements, provide all the documentation that's required as part of the process in order for them to qualify for that examination.
And when you say examination, you're referring specifically to the barrister and solicitor examinations.
That's right. Those are our licensing examinations that all candidates that seek licensure in Ontario have to complete successfully before they can become licensed, among other things, of course.
And a question I get asked all the time, and it's hard for me to keep up, is whether you need to write the licensing. So when we say licensing exams, we're just going to call it licensing exams, the barrister and solicitor exams. Can you write it at any point until you're called to the bar, or do you have to write it before you article? Or do the LPP program? Because I know there's a few ways to become a lawyer in Ontario.
Right. A couple of avenues in terms of completing the experiential training component, but certainly there is flexibility within the licensing process of when you complete certain things. So typically candidates write their exams for the first time in the summer sitting and then proceed to complete their experiential training. But that's not mandatory and it's not required. So there are a few options and there's flexibility built in that a candidate can choose to write one examination in the summer sitting and perhaps do the second examination in the fall. So they can move their scheduling around to accommodate their professional responsibilities, their family responsibility, financial need as well, because of course the examinations aren't free. So there is flexibility in terms of when you complete one or both the exams and also when you can do your articles. With the law practice program, which is the other avenue that you can engage with to complete your experiential training requirement, there is a little bit more of a limitation in that that program has set start and finish dates. And the program typically commences at the end of August, beginning of September, and goes all the way through to the following April. And so with that program, it is a set period of time where the candidates will complete the first in-class portion of the LPP and then followed up by the work placement portion of the LPP.
So when do the LPP students typically sit the licensing exams? Before the LPP program?
It's hard to say, and it changes from one year to the next. Most individuals want to do the examinations before they have the fun of the law practice program or their articles, because it is a busy program. It is, you know, it's demanding, just like any experiential training program. And so some people prefer to do it unencumbered, you know, in the summer or the following year. So there is that flexibility built in, and they prefer not to write exams during the law practice program or their articling placement for that matter.
And so for our international students that are coming and they're really on the ball and they want to get things moving, do they have to have their certificate from the NCA prior to registering for the licensing process?
So when they apply, no, they don't need to have their certificate of qualification on file with the LSO. They're just opening up their online account with us, their profile, all that fun stuff that sort of starts the ball rolling. So they don't have to have the CQ in hand. However, if they want to start an experiential training program or write the exam and meet the registration deadlines for either of those components, they certainly must have that sent over from the NCA and in our hands, because we need to review that, ensure that they've met the admission requirements, and then they, you know, start on their path to completing the requirements once they have that in their file with the LSO.
So they can sign up, create a profile, but in terms of actually, can they still sign up for the exam, or they would need but it's not possible for them to write the exam without the CQ.
Right. They haven't completed registration unless that CQ is in the LSO's file for them. So they can start the process, right? So they can submit the application online, collect their documentation, have all of their information certified and sent to the LSO for review. However, their registration isn't complete until that portion of the application is also met in the way of what I mean is receiving the CQ, the certificate of qualification. That has to be in our hands before anything is commenced. And it It has to be done before the applicable registration deadline. So any candidate, for example, that wants to write the following summer, typically the registration deadlines fall somewhere in early April. And so that's when they would need to meet that timeline to qualify for that sitting.
Okay, so there's a deadline to apply for each of the sittings. And if you miss that deadline, you'd have to wait for the following sittings.
Correct. Yes. So there are deadlines for each examination sitting, for each exam, frankly. And there's also a deadline to register for the law practice program, which normally falls in and around mid-June of each year. And so registration for us means ensuring that they've fully applied, submitted all of their documentation in support of the application, and had the certificate of qualification submitted by the NCA to the LSO.
And where would the deadlines be posted on the LSO website?
That's an excellent question. We actually have dedicated pages to this information because there are, you know, a lot of options of what you can do throughout the licensing process. So we post all of the examination deadlines on the licensing examination section of the website. So if everyone bookmarks the lso.ca website, from there, they'll be able to access the information under the Becoming Licensed tab at the top. And then underneath Becoming Licensed for Lawyers, they'll be able to find not only examination deadlines and dates, but they'll also be able to find what's called the Dates to Remember section. And the Dates to Remember section is sort of an overall page with relevant deadlines.
For example, I'm right here.
Yeah, good. That was quick. That means I walked you through just right.
That's how easy it is, guys.
and so that page you'll see has information about accommodation deadlines, which are important as well. They have, we include deadlines about certain payment plans that are available to our candidates navigating through the process. A lot of other, you know, transcript deadlines for other candidates and so on and so forth. There's a lot of information there. And so I really, really recommend that this Dates to Remember page, as well as the examination dates and deadline page, are bookmarked very early on, because you'll be referring to those pages quite frequently.
So what you would suggest is anyone that's thinking of going through this process, do it early with plenty of time, because there's quite a few steps and documentation required. Is that what you would say? Give yourself plenty of time.
Yeah,
I'm reading it right now. It looks very good.
Yeah, plenty of time. But I will say, and we'll talk a little bit more about this later on in our sort of tips of do's and don'ts, I wouldn't suggest applying a year in advance, for example, because it's just too early. You don't have your CQ kind of imminently going to be sent to the LSO. So there's no need to apply that early. But I'd say several months would give you a good sense of what you need to do and when you need to do it by, for sure. The other thing I wanted to mention before I forget, sorry, is once candidates are in the process, we message them quite frequently with information like their invoices, and those invoices have deadlines on them too. And we also send gentle prompts so that they can be reminded of imminent deadlines if they've selected a particular sitting. So there is information that is pushed out to the students after they've entered the program, so that they can meet those deadlines.
And if students are looking through the website like Kim is right now and maybe have questions, or if they're submitting a document that they don't know if they should submit it, or any kind of questions at all, who would they go to? Is there a support section on the website, or what's best for questions?
Well, I was going to jokingly say Panina, but no, it's actually our team in licensing and accreditation. My team deals with all things licensing process and experiential training programs. So I would suggest the first stop would be, once you've applied, to message us through your online account, because as you're going through the application process, an account, a personal and confidential account, is created for you with an ID number and all of the stuff that goes along with that. And you can message us confidentially through your online account. I would say that's the the best, most effective and efficient way to reach out to us. It's also a good way for us to keep track of your messages so that we see if we've dealt with you before, we kind of have a sense of what you require, what you may have discussed with some of our staff previously. And it's super helpful for us to get up to speed very quickly so that we're able to help you the next time you call in or message in.
And in terms of, I think I want to circle back to our the licensing process. Would you be able to just elaborate on the sittings? Because I know it can kind of get a little confusing in terms of how many exams you can write. If you are very sadly unsuccessful, what are your opportunities to rewrite? Is there a limit? Is there a deadline to complete the licensing exams? Maybe you can speak a little bit more about the exams themselves. Now that you've already kind of explained how you go through the application process. So let's say I'm ready to write the first exam. What would that look like? What are my options?
So just a few things on the examinations. You have three attempts at each of the licensing examinations, but if you're unsuccessful on all three of those attempts, you may apply for a fourth attempt. You do have to meet certain conditions, and those are set out in the licensing process policies. And Gina just described where to find the Dates to Remember tab. The licensing process policies are just two below on the left-hand navigation, so they're also very easy to find, and that will set out what you have to meet in order to be eligible for a fourth attempt at either of the licensing examinations. You do have your licensing term to complete the licensing examinations, which is typically around 3 years. So sometimes people mistakenly think that they only have 1 year to do it, but that's not the case. They have the full licensing term. If they're not sure of when their term ends, they can always message us through the online account that Gina just mentioned. So there's probably more flexibility than people might initially think. And just to your question, Kim, about the licensing examinations, people are sometimes unsuccessful and people shouldn't feel alone if that occurs. They should recognize that there is a reason why there are three attempts at the licensing examination. It means that there are other people who've been through the same situation as they're going through, and they shouldn't let it affect them too harshly. And we are also available if they do have questions, not about the content of the licensing examination, but how to interpret a document that we provide to them. If they are unsuccessful, they can contact us and we can assist them with understanding that document, which might provide them with some assistance for a future attempt.
And is there tutoring available that the Law Study offers for candidates who are sadly, and we say sadly because it's going to be a tough pill to swallow for anybody who's unsuccessful, but when, you know, try and try again, that shouldn't be the hurdle for you becoming a successful lawyer. What resources does the Law Study offer to candidates who are not successful at their first or second attempt?
So the first thing I would say is that if a person is unsuccessful, they should definitely review the document that is provided to them that provides them with information on how to interpret how they performed on the licensing examination. That's a valuable piece of information that we do provide to candidates who are unsuccessful. And that can assist them with understanding, is it just a given subject area that is at issue, or is it certain competency category that is of issue? So they should definitely look at that. If they don't understand what they're seeing, they can contact us. The next step after that would be to look at some of those candidate supports that are available. And we just mentioned the website. A few more sort of lines down on that left navigation on the website is candidate support. And there's a little plus sign beside it. And if they click on the plus sign, they will see information about tutoring. They will also see information about accommodation. So from the tutoring perspective, currently candidates who have been unsuccessful in a licensing examination are eligible to apply for tutoring. It's very important to read over the policy that applies to tutoring to make sure that they've met the requirements. And also in some cases, I will say that a candidate may be unsuccessful on an examination because they require an accommodation and either they did not want to seek an accommodation or weren't aware of the cause of the need for the accommodation. So they should also look at the accommodations tab, read over the material there, and that might provide them with some insight because that may be something that they require.
That's amazing. I am on the website and it is super easy to understand. It does say I can request a maximum of 5 hours tutoring in total, which I think is amazing. Would that be, let's say that someone's unsuccessful in the barrister and the solicitor exam. Do they get 5 hours per exam or tutoring in total? I assume that's total.
That's correct. No, currently they can have up to 5 hours of tutoring in up to three different subject areas per license examination. So the barrister examination, they can have up to 5 hours, and the solicitor examination, if they're unsuccessful in that examination, they can have up to 5 hours of tutoring.
Oh, wow. That's great.
Well, that's really good. Also a good opportunity to meet other lawyers and network, and maybe you can make some lemonade out of some lemons.
Exactly. There you go. Well, while we're on the topic of kind of supporting the students, what other kind of support or assistance does LSO offer to candidates?
So we do have some financial supports that are available. And again, under that candidate support section of the website, anyone that clicks on that will see that there is an opportunity for our candidates to make partial payments for their tuition. What it's called is the monthly payment plan. And there's some prescribed plans that they can sign up for in order to spread out payments for their law society licensing process fees. The other program that the law society has is the repayable allowance program, which is a loan program for candidates in need. And anyone that meets those defined kind of requirements for that program can submit an application in order to get up to $5,000 of assistance currently. And it is, again, a loan program, but it does help candidates pay off some of their tuition fees or potentially some living expenses while they're in the licensing process.
Yeah, maybe help people kind of complete the process earlier than what they could have, right? If they have to wait to pay it all up front. I think that's really helpful for a lot of candidates, for sure.
Yeah.
I'm going to just take this opportunity, even though it's not for candidates, I just wanted to mention the Coach and Advisor Network, which is an option once people become licensees. They can look at the Coach and Advisor Network. I understand that's not what we're talking about today, but I think it's a great program that's available to newer licensees that they're certainly encouraged to look at our website for information on that as well. So a little bit.
I have a lawyer who swears by that.
Is it a mentor program?
It's coach or advisor. So there's two different arms to the program. I'm not sure that I would, how I would characterize it other than what it's sort of called. One really provides a little bit more longer term and one is a little bit more shorter term type of situation. So that's it. If you look on the website under the Coach and Advisor Network, that's all described there. But that's a bit of a foreshadow. But,
So it's once you become a lawyer and you're stuck on a file or you have questions. I have one colleague. She's I haven't done it yet, but she's you need a coach, or you should go on the Law Society website. They have coaches. You can call them. They're really good. They're really helpful. I'm always like, yeah, I'm gonna do it. But then I haven't yet, but it's on my list because she swears by it. And I think it's actually super helpful. It's just a little add-on for lawyers. And so it's kind of like anything, like some who do it are like hooked, they swear by it. And it's a nice idea. You know what? I'm going to do it. And I'm going to talk about it on the podcast.
I think it's a good idea too, because a lot of people have questions that they think are they're the only ones that have the question, but they're not. But that's they're maybe scared to ask their colleagues are scared to, ask their boss or whatnot, or maybe people just started off with their own firm and have some questions. I think that's a really helpful program that you're offering.
To talk to other colleagues in like a similar practice area, or you have something that you're stuck on. And obviously these lawyers signed up for the program. So they're saying, yes, please call me with questions. And it's a good networking opportunity. I think it's pretty cool.
For sure.
I'm excited to try it out and report back.
Good to hear. I also, just before we step away from candidate supports, the Law Society also has something called MAP, which is, we love our short forms, but it stands for Member Assistance Program. And it's another resource available to licensees and candidates, and it's provided by Homewood Health. And it's a confidential service that's funded by, but fully independent of, the Law Society of Ontario and LawPro. And what it is it's access to counseling, coaching, online resources, and it assists our candidates in getting help with issues related to addictions, mental health, work-life balance. The last couple of years, it's become very, very important, I think, for all of our potential licensees and licensees to seek help in these areas, career, family, all sorts of topic areas that they can explore with or through this program.
So I guess it's really important then that the LSO supports not only candidates, but supports lawyers when they start and kind of throughout their career. So don't just ignore the website once you become a lawyer. Take a look at all the different supports they offer.
Is that support available for candidates? Like if you're a candidate?
Yes. It is available to candidates, students that are going through the licensing process, certainly.
It's even available to law students.
Yeah.
Oh,
oh, wow.
That.
That's really great.
What about
great.
Students who haven't gotten their QC yet and they've kind of, they're in the process of, the registration's not complete?
They'll have to reach out specifically to them to confirm that, but I believe so.
I understand that the MP program,
Member MAP,
thank you. Every report I read is that it's not taken advantage of as much as it could be, that the resources are there and there's still a stigma for lawyers and candidates who don't want to reach out for whatever reason. And I think it's really important that Gina mentioned that it is separate from the Law Society, independent from the Law Society. I think it's an interesting resource that people may feel still too cautious to, to engage in for whatever reason. But we just did a podcast on resilience and we're going to continue to discuss mental health in this profession. And the fact that the Law Society has resources available and they aren't being used is very interesting, I think.
Yeah, I think that's true. I've talked to a number of people who've used the program and I think that we are moving away from any concept of stigma. I certainly see a lot of conversation, a lot of people really moving away from that concept and just recognizing that it's a challenging process. Law school is a challenging process. Being a lawyer or a paralegal is a challenging process. So I think people are starting to recognize that certain categories of individuals in connection with their work are in a heightened situation of challenge, and it makes a lot of sense to contact other people to find out if they're in the same situation, what the impact of it is, how to move forward from a given situation. So I guess from my perspective, I think your point is very well taken, Kim, and it's very important for people to recognize, it goes back to the idea I mentioned before about examinations, even if somebody is unsuccessful on an examination, to recognize that there are lots of other people in the same situation. So none of us is alone, and we should definitely take advantage of the resources that are available to us to assist us moving forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, writing the exams themselves is a really stressful endeavor. I'm sure Kim will agree with me that is a stressful day. That is a stressful time leading up to that exam, whether you're doing your articling or before or after. So I guess maybe you can give our listeners some insight on what that exam day looks like, maybe how they should prepare for it. What should they expect when writing their barrister or solicitor exam?
Sure. So Gina, maybe I'll start with this and then turn it over to you. I think the most important thing in order to feel confident walking into the licensing examinations is to be well prepared. I think there is nothing that beats preparedness. When you walk in knowing that you know your material's cold, that really assists even with the stress management. You know, you mentioned that, Samantha. Like, I think it really helps if you know your materials well. So I would say first, if you feel like you're not fully prepared, you can reach out and defer your licensing examination. Keep your eye on your deadlines. And if you're before the deferral deadline and you think you're not prepared and are not going to be prepared, I know that sometimes it can seem to candidates like they have to do things at a certain time. They have to be with this peer or they're comparing themselves to that peer. I would very much encourage people to think about themselves, their own situation. And if you're not ready, if you really haven't had the time you needed, maybe you had a family situation, maybe school went longer than you expected, maybe work was really busy, you had no time to study. Everybody has different situations. Maybe you were ill. Please take the time, step a little bit back, can recognize that you're not really quite ready, take the time. You have a long period of time. You have, you know, sort of approximately 3 years to write those licensing examinations successfully. And the older that a person becomes, and I think I'm the oldest one that is sort of on this part of the side of the conversation, the older one becomes, the more one realizes that there's plenty of time not to rush. When you're starting out, you'll have lots of time to practice, and you'll have lots of time to practice here in Ontario. So, you know, take the time and walk in prepared. That would be the first thing I would say for the examination. And then, of course, there's reading the information that's on the website. We have a guide to licensing examinations that's posted on our website. We have rules and protocol. Those are very important because, you know, there are a lot of rules to ensure the security of the licensing examination. So please read those over carefully. Make sure you bring in only the things you're permitted to bring in. Make sure that you recognize which things you will not be allowed to remove from the licensing examination room. Those are all very important things so that you're not surprised on the day of, because the information is all there and available for everyone to read in advance. So please, I would encourage all of you who are listening to read over the guide to licensing examinations and rules and protocol. And then there are some study tips in the guide to licensing examination. I encourage you to read those over as well. So being prepared and then knowing that you're going to be walking into an examination room, if you're writing in the regular sitting type of situation with a lot of other people in the room. So prepare yourself for that mentally. And that can really assist you with, you know, sort of calming any nerves that you might have, because you recognize, yes, I'll be in a room with other people. That's okay. For candidates who receive an accommodation, their situation may be a little bit different.
We'll be right back. You don't want to miss this.
Hey, Kim, aren't you part of the LLM program at Osgoode?
Yeah, I'm doing an LLM in dispute resolution. What about you?
Yeah, I'm also doing an LLM. It's a part-time business law LLM.
Well, if you want to stand out from the crowd with an LLM from one of Canada's oldest and most prestigious law schools, Osgoode PD, the professional development arm of Osgoode Hall Law School, offers the broadest range of programs in Canada for internationally trained lawyers.
With 17 LLM specializations, 2 graduate diplomas, legal English programs, and countless non-credit options, there's sure to be a program that fits your goals. Students choose Osgoode PD because of the reputation for academic excellence and unmatched student and career services.
Osgoode also offers entrance awards of up to $30,000 for international students applying to full-time LLM programs.
So if you want to learn more about your options, you can visit osgoodepd.ca/get-started.
I think I read those rules. Sorry, just interject. I think I read those rules probably 10 times before I went into that room to make sure I had only what I could have in that Ziploc bag. I was so paranoid about bringing in things that I couldn't have. So I suggest you print it off and you check mark what you're allowed to have.
Highlight
and
it.
Only bring in. You highlight it. Like you treat it like a study. Because I remember reviewing it and just wanting to make absolute sure that I was only bringing in what I was allowed to bring in. And I think you really mentioned a really good point about being mentally prepared. It is, it's a grueling day and it's a tiring day, and you are in a room with many other people. And I think that, you know, people prepare mentally for different things, different ways, but I think that you really have to kind of go into a zone and try to block out all the noises around you and everything else around you. And I think that that's important for students to know as well. I mean, it's people get through it, obviously, but it's a tiring day. So I think you to kind of mentally prepare for that is important too. I'm sure Gina has some stuff she can share.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, we all know these are high stakes exams, right? So they affect your career and your plans. And certainly we know that there's a stress level there with any examination relating to licensure. But I think to your points, Sam, about reading that information and being prepared is super helpful, only because the last thing you want is to get into that zone and then arrive at the site and realize, oh my gosh, I shouldn't be bringing this. Oh my gosh, why are they taking that? Why am I checking this? So all of those little hiccups, you know, it's not the end of the world, of course, but it can kind of ruin your mojo for sure. So we don't want that to happen. We want everyone to review the info, be prepared, bring what they should and leave out what they shouldn't. But it is sort of, you know, it's a formal examination setting. So it may be a little bit different for some candidates who've never had that before, who've never experienced that before. For example, like you mentioned, the space is vast in a lot of these locations. And so our candidates are coming in, they're checking their coat first, their personal effects. They're moving to registration. And again, our staff is there to guide them through every step of the process. There's no figure it out yourself, guys. We're over here. Come find us. So certainly, you know, after coat check, you're going to check in with registration. You're going to be given your seat number because seats are assigned. Again, back to that formal examination process. And then you're going to go through a security checkpoint and they will kind of look at your materials and what you're bringing in. And once you're good to go, you will proceed to your assigned seat in the hall. So, you know, there's background noise, there's people walking up and down the aisles, and people need to be prepared for that, right? You're not in a kind of silo writing on your own, for sure.
I think also go early. Give yourself plenty of time that morning. I wrote my barrister exam in a winter term, and I remember checking the weather days leading up to it to make sure that the weather was going to be okay and that I could get there. So, you know, if you have to wait in that parking lot 2 hours prior to the start of the exam, then do it. I would say, you know, if you're taking transit, go as early as possible. Like you said, Gina, you don't want those little stresses to make the day even more stressful. So try to be as easy on yourself as possible. Go early, have your coffee in your car, and just give yourself ample time to get to whatever testing center you're going to. I remember being really stressed about that.
Oh my God, me too. And I didn't drink that much water either because I was like, I didn't want to go have to use the bathroom. Actually, in the middle of the exam, yeah. I was so worried because every second counts.
Absolutely. I did the same thing, which isn't good advice. I would say you probably should drink water during the exam. but I felt the same. I was really anxious about kind of, you know, getting up from my seat and taking away from time I had to write it. So, you know, everyone prepares in different ways, but I think that whatever you can do to kind of alleviate that stress day of, do it. Don't pre-plan. Don't just say, oh, I have an exam on Tuesday and I'll be fine. I think that a benefit actually to our NCA students is that they'll have already, a lot of them will have already written a series of a few exams by then. So they might have a benefit of writing an exam in a big space like that. But yeah, my advice would just be go early and prep.
So they're not online anymore. They're in person.
Correct.
That's what I'm gauging from this discussion. Yes. And they'll be in person from now on.
They are currently scheduled for in-person. In fact, a few times during our conversation, I have talked about currently. So I think that's a really important piece to reinforce. What we're saying is what's current as of the date that we're having this conversation. Mm-hmm. Information would be posted to our website or sent to candidates through their online Law Society account if information changed. We can only speak to what is currently the case.
Yeah, we don't have a crystal ball here as of the current recording. And I'll note we're recording this December 2022. So keep that in mind.
And I'm assuming that the website's updated often. So I guess the best place for updated information is always going to be on your website.
And their accounts, right? So we do provide information to candidates sometimes through one method and sometimes through the other. One might be first, the other might be first. We're definitely paying attention to those online accounts. And it automatically, if I'm correct about this, Gina, sends a message to their email address. When we've sent something to them through their online account, they can automatically get that.
Yes. So once we send a message or release a message in their online account, there is a prompt that's sent to the personal address that they signed up with, kind of alerting them to a new message in their account, which is super helpful, especially if you're managing multiple accounts on different systems, so that you don't miss anything. But I would recommend that after the application period, all of our applicants check in with their online account at least once or twice a week to make sure that they haven't missed anything. And if it's okay with everyone, I'd kind of like to finish off the application and then get into the registration timelines and kind of what to expect after the application period. So
please do.
Yeah, please.
Go for it.
I want to hear this.
Typically, what occurs in terms of the application period is we release the application in the fall of 1 year, and the deadline to apply is usually in December. In early December, rather. And it's okay if someone misses that deadline, other than the fact that they would have a late fee applied to their application. We do have continuous intake. So it's not just between, you know, the fall and December period that we accept applications. We accept them throughout the year. So candidates are free to apply anytime. They just may not meet the deadline for the exam that they preferred. So we do recommend that they keep an eye on the deadlines for each examination that they want to select. So after the application period in December, usually we start reaching out in January and early February to candidates to advise them if they're missing anything from their application. So that's why I encourage them to keep looking into their online account just to make sure, oh, you know, their documents weren't certified or you're missing X, Y, Z document to support the application. Once that period passes, usually in February, you are invoiced for your examinations and your study materials. That's typically the timeline if you follow the application period and apply by December. So in February, we release the invoices to our candidates. And then they have the opportunity to make payment for those exam fees and the study materials by sometime in April, usually, if they're writing a summer sitting. If they're not writing a summer sitting and they're writing in a subsequent sitting, then there is an applicable deadline that's on the invoice and they're, you know, they're told when they need to make that payment by. But if they want access to the materials in April when they're released for that licensing term, they can pay by that deadline and gain immediate access. Even though they may be writing a couple of sittings from now, they'll still have the opportunity to access that material, that study material, so that they can start studying as soon as possible if they like. So that's sort of the lay of the land of, you know, what will stack up after they apply online and submit their paper application.
So it's quite early. Like if you're kind of looking at December to write a summer the following year, basically. So there's a long leadway, more than I thought, actually.
Yeah, we do it like that, obviously, because we want to allow candidates the opportunity to enroll in a payment plan because their invoices are released in February. And payment isn't due until April. So we want to give them opportunities to make those payments, to enroll in the payment plan, to request repayable allowance mm-hmm. loans, and also to for our planning purposes, right? These venues are rather large. There's a lot of logistics that go into it, a lot of planning that needs to be done on the large sites as well as the smaller accommodated sites.
Yeah, of course. And you want to and everyone's application, you know, while they're very similar, you have to review each one individually. So that takes time. So if you wanted to write in summer and you wanted the materials in advance, so that's something that you'd have to really look at the deadlines to consider. And it makes sense actually now that you mentioned that not to apply too far in advance.
Yes. It's several months, I would say. A year would be too much because you couldn't do anything really, right? Mm-hmm. You're not able to access the following year's materials in any event. So yeah, it's not helpful, I would think.
And I wanted to mention just Kim's point about the materials. So the materials come out annually and they come out at a certain period of time. Some candidates may feel like they have to write the very next available exam, but those materials are applicable to the not only the upcoming exam, but also to following that. So if they feel that they need more time to study, right, they shouldn't feel they need to write that summer, which some people do feel that sense of, you know, requirement to write right away, but they do have some time. So if that hasn't been enough time for them to really review those materials the way they want to, they can write in the following fall or winter using those same licensing examination study materials.
Oh, so summer, fall, winter are all the same materials. And then in the summer, it resets. So and that's kind of the cycle, really.
Correct.
Right. That's the licensing year within the licensing term. So there's a difference there. There's up to three sittings available in a licensing year. And the materials would apply to all of those three sittings. And then, as you said, and put it so eloquently, it sort of resets. And for the new licensing year, there's a new set of materials that candidates would need to purchase, because that's what the examinations, the next three sittings of the examinations, are based on.
And the term is the 3 years to complete both exams.
That's right.
Would it start? So if I start summer, would the term be till three summers later? Is that the easiest way to think about it? Or is it a little more complicated?
Does it change for everyone?
It can change depending on when they apply and when they actually commence a component. So if anyone does have any questions about when their term starts and when their term ends, I encourage them to reach out to us and we'll clarify depending on their situation. It really all depends on when they're applying and in the process.
Okay, that's helpful. I actually wanted to go back to the exams because I wanted to mention that there, and I'm on the website, and I thought two very interesting things was, one, that you can write the exams in French, if that is your preference. And the other thing I really think is important to mention, and maybe we can have you elaborate, is the confidentiality and security of study materials, that the exams are meant to be kept confidential. It's extremely important that any candidate who writes the exam doesn't share what is on the exam and keeps it confidential, doesn't put it on any social media or anything, keeps it to themselves. Are you able to talk about how important confidentiality and security of the materials are for these exams?
It is crucial that candidates recognize that what we're doing when we're giving a licensing examination is we're assessing entry-level competence. And at the outset of this conversation, we talked about the fact that lawyers and paralegals self-regulate and self-govern in the public interest. And it's very much in the public interest that they can be assured that those individuals who have been licensed are competent to practice law or provide legal services. So for that reason, it's crucial that information about the licensing examination that is not public information is not disclosed to anyone else. So for example, the guide to licensing examinations, people can talk about the guide. That's a document that's on our website. People can talk about the rules and protocol. That's a document that's on our website. But when they go into the licensing examination, they're seeing information that is intended to assess entry-level competence. And if that information is disclosed, then that's a very challenging situation with respect to ensuring that we can regulate in the public interest. So I think the rules and protocol are very clear about how important that is, and every candidate is required to abide by those rules and protocol.
I also wanted to say that really all you need to study are the study materials that are provided by the LSO. So that is upon which the exams are based. And but to Penina's point, there's a lot more information in terms of studying and what's permitted and what you can and cannot do or should and should not do on the website, for sure. Important to review all of that information.
Yeah, but you bring up a good point. It's the study materials that the Law Society provides for you is all you need for the, I mean, they're very dense. So I remember taking me.
Tabbing that goes on in that thing, I'll tell you that much.
I remember taking me an hour to read 10 pages.
Yeah,
it is. With my like 10 highlighters. So
some topics are easier than others. Well, just depending on your specialty or maybe what's of interest to you, but definitely it's a lot.
And read the rules of professional conduct. That's at the end. All the bylaws. Oh.
There's definitely a lot of material in the study materials, but I will say that a lot of candidates create study schedules for themselves, so they recognize that they're not going to be able to do the entire reading in the last week before the licensing examination. So creating that schedule, figuring out how many pages you're going to read or how many chapters you're going to read, when you're going to do your reviews, and building time into that schedule for unanticipated situations. So for example, if you're like cutting it to the wire, that's going to be very difficult, because what if you do get sick, or what if, you know, you have a child and your child gets sick, or what if you're working part-time or full-time at the same time and they require you to work extra. So it's very important to build some of those contingencies into your schedule and to create that type of schedule to keep you on track. And again, as I said before, if you're not ready, to recognize that by the deferral deadline, submit your deferral request and write at a later time.
I think that's a really good point. I think that a lot of candidates think that they need to stay on this schedule and they need to write and do their article at a certain time and get called at a certain time. And they put these deadlines on themselves. And I think that it's important to note that everyone's different and everyone has a different situation and you're not the same as your friends. And, you know, if you're part of a study group, you might end up writing in different cities and that's okay. Kind of just make sure to kind of stay on your own path, I think is an important one for this. This is what your career is going to be based off of. It's a big step. And I think that I think that a lot of people try to rush it. And I would just say
these exams require a lot of your time and attention. I studied every day, 6 weeks in a row, 12-hour days at the Starbucks. Christine DuPont, which is actually no longer there. They had a vault. Literally, it was a bank. I was in the vault and it was so cold and dark that I brought a lamp. I brought a blanket.
Wow.
I, like, that's commitment.
Sounds like a dark experience.
Yeah, it was a very
I don't know if I'd
time.
Recommend that.
But. I had a friend.
Donata's message is really a good one because if you learn that lesson now, not to compare yourself, not to feel like you have to do something else, that actually does you, I think, in good stead in practice, because I think in practice, the same type of situation can arise where you're trying to keep up with this person or that person. And, you know, we talked earlier about the member assistance program. I think trying to always compare yourself to others is sort of a more general kind of topic, but trying to always compare yourself to others and, you know, keep up with the neighbors, that kind of thing. I think it can be really harmful to somebody's mental health. So recognizing right at the outset of your career that you're on your own path and you don't have to compare yourself to somebody else's path is such a good approach to take right at the outset.
And everybody gets there in the end. Yeah. Everybody gets there. It's just a matter of, you know, being patient and it's called licensing process for a reason, right? Yeah.
And now a word from our sponsors.
Hey, I'm Caroline from Lumos. We help lawyers choose the best legal software. And one thing not to neglect in your resume is to showcase that you're familiar with practice management software, because every law firm uses this, and how to use time and expense entry, or even the basics of billing. Our course teaches you this, and it has a blurb you can just directly add to your resume to prove to employers you're already familiar with the software. So it's at Lumos Marketplace, LUMOSE marketplace.com/courses. See you there.
So are there any other kind of tips and tricks that you guys would have for everyone that maybe haven't been mentioned yet?
I have a couple of things to mention. Panina, obviously jump in anytime here. So we've talked about, of course, reading the website info, preparing early, just reviewing all of the available resources and information on the website. That one will go without saying. So as soon as you have that in hand, a couple of things that I wanted to mention for sure, don't start experiential training without a certificate of qualification on file. We do have candidates that, you know, kind of reach out to us and say, What do you mean? I've been articling for a couple of months and they have no certificate. They don't retain any of that credit because of that, because they're not able to start. And so that's an important thing. Keeping in close contact with licensing and accreditation about all things experiential training is very important, because you don't want to shortchange yourself for time that you've worked in a placement when there's no need to do that. So definitely
no need, meaning the time you did doesn't count towards your experiential training.
If you are not qualified to start the placement, meaning we don't have a certificate of qualification, you will not get credit for it. And so
what if you have it, but just never submitted to the Law Society kind of thing?
Well, that's, you know, a discussion you can have with us, mm-hmm. certainly. However, in most instances, that is definitely a no-no. Or if you haven't finished your application, we have some candidates that, you know, submit the application online and for some reason, for whatever reason, don't do part two of the application, which is submitting the second part of it with the supporting documentation. So, you know, completing the application is step number one. And I know it sounds very simple and back to basics, but you would be surprised how many people just think that the online application is the only piece to it. So we want to make sure that, you know, you're not putting the cart in front of the horse, so that you're applying fully first, then you're registering, then you're doing your exams or experience.
Well, that makes sense, because I, as an articling principal, I have the Law Society sends me an email and has to make sure that within, I think, 10 days of starting, there is a whole plan for the student. So if you don't have that, then yes, you're not an articling student, because that's the Law Society regulates that process of experiential training. So this makes perfect sense.
We want to make sure, to your point, that there's oversight. We want to make sure that, you know, the principal is approved, because of course there is a process by which the Law Society approves principals to make sure that they're suitable to supervise and mentor the candidates throughout the process. So for sure, it's, you know, stacking everything up in the right way, right from the start, is the best way to put your best foot forward, and not, you know, kind of shoot yourself in the foot, so to speak. So definitely, you know, follow what's on the website, complete each part of the process that's required of you in terms of application and registration. I think that that's very important. And, you know, I get it. There's a lot of information on the website. It's a lot to absorb, but you know, if you're not able to suss it out and figure it out, definitely reach out to us. That's why we're here. That's why my entire team, that's their bread and butter, is to guide candidates throughout the process and make sure that they've done the administrative requirements. You don't want that to trip you up and delay your licensing.
I called the Law Society's articling placement so many times back in
Good.
The day.
That's what we're there for, right? That's what the resource is there for. That's why we have them, because we want to make sure. And the thing is it's not that the process is so complex. It's that there are so many variations with our candidates and our placement supervisors. And we want to make sure to set you up for success. That's our key. That's our mission, so to speak. So reach out to us whenever you're in doubt. For sure. But I will say, please don't send multiple messages via multiple channels. Mm-hmm. That is something that we've experienced, I think, more with the onset of the last couple of years in the pandemic situation, where, you know, there's a heightened sense of stress and reaching a live person. The best way to get through to us, honestly, is through your online account. There's a record of it. It can't get lost, you know, that's the best way, rather than sitting on the phone for half an hour on hold, because our phone lines are busy at certain times of the year, especially around deadlines and registration periods and things of that nature. So, you know, send the message in the format that you prefer. If you feel like you want to call us, that's fine too. But I would say the online message is the best way to reach out to us and get your answer.
And if I could add one quick tip, I would say that candidates should recognize that they are now entering into a professional situation. They are becoming professionals in Ontario. So if you are having difficulty in your experiential training program, for example, maybe with an articling principal or a work placement supervisor, try to approach the situation as a professional, you know, maybe having a conversation, maybe dealing with things as a professional is expected to do in a civil and appropriate manner. If the matter is one that can't be resolved, then we do have some resources like Discrimination and Harassment Council. And we do have, you know, charts on our information on our website about preventing and addressing harassment and discrimination. But if something is not at that end of serious and is something that you can resolve, it's just an regular interpersonal situation or conflict, do what you can from your side to try and resolve the matter, just acting as you would expect anyone who's about to become a lawyer in Ontario to do. So I would recommend that people start that process early rather than having things turn into a significantly negative situation. I would very much encourage that.
And just to, this articling's 8 months now, right?
Currently.
Currently. Thanks, Nina. I needed that word, currently, not now.
Yes. Prior to 2020, anyone who commenced an articling placement had to do the full 10 months. Mm-hmm. So we've reduced that to 8 months, minimum 8 months now.
And I as an articling principal, I find there is information for articling principals, which are extremely helpful. One thing I think is interesting to just note is that the Law Society requires articling principals to give candidates who have not written a first attempt to their licensing examinations 7 days of a time off to write the exams, but those 7 days don't count towards your experiential training time. They're added on at the end. Am I correct?
For the most part, I would say. So candidates do have a certain number of days off that they can take during their articling term. So those days can count toward that, but you still have that limit that's set out in the requirements. There's a limited number of days that you can take off. And so if you take more than that number of days, even if it's for study days, you have to add it on to the end of your term.
Yes. So I think it's important for candidates to keep in mind if they need more personal days and they need more time to study for the exam, to check out what the Law Society states in terms of how much time off you're permitted. I think I last read it was 10 days of time off that you can take, and it won't add any more time to your article. This is articling specifically, not the LPP program. That's different. Right. And there's, in addition to the 10 days, there can be 7 days per exam, but that has to be that if you wanted 10 plus the 14 would be added on yet. I don't know Sam, does that make any sense?
Yeah, I think they should just check the website because it might change. So
that's true.
You're unsure. Yeah.
But that's exactly right. You would have to add on days if you exceed that number of permitted days. And for the regular articling duration, it would be currently, I think it's 10 days. I think you're right.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much. This has been so helpful I've enjoyed the refresher, Sam.
Yeah, I think that I would have really benefited from a podcast on this topic prior to writing my exam. So I hope that it will help some people, maybe guide them if they're just starting out or just starting to look into the LSO process. I think this has been really helpful. So thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you so much. This has been great. I remember my first articling student said to me, are you eligible to be an articling principal? I was like, I think so. And they're like, did you fill out the form on the Law Society's website? I'm like, oh, so yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of steps that need to be taken and there's a lot of deadlines. So being prepared and having you here and explain it to us in like layman's terms is super helpful. And the website's pretty good too. So
I also think it's helpful just for people to know there's actual people behind this, the LSO, and they're here to help. And and I think that a lot of times people just go onto a website and they just think that, you know, who's behind there. So I think it's really helpful to actually hear from people behind the scenes.
And we work pretty close. Like we try to have representatives from Law Society come to some of our events, speak about these exact topics, really good like resources and people available to help and use them, I guess, is the other side of the coin. Like there is help here, reach out. And that's, yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It's been our pleasure.
Awesome. Thanks guys. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you for listening. Tell us what you want to hear. Follow us at NCA Network on social or email us info@ncanetwork.com.